Welcome to the Ackerman Center podcast.
As a digital extension of the Ackerman Center, our goal is to teach the past so we can change the future.
In doing so, we address issues related to the Holocaust, genocide, and human rights studies from diverse perspectives.
Welcome to the Ackerman Center podcast. My name is Dr. Emily Rose Baker. I'm an assistant professor of film studies here at UT Dallas, and I'm joined today by special guest Sabina Vajrača. She is an award-winning film director from Bosnia and Herzegovina, who immigrated to the US as a war refugee at the age of 14, and whose work deals with representations of inter-ethnic trauma and conflict, particularly pertaining to the Bosnian War and genocide, as well as the Holocaust. This conversation grows out of a larger Ackerman Center project called Screening Genocide, which comprised a series of student workshops on genocide film and has culminated in a new film blog. Today, we're going to be talking about Sabina's recent film Variables, the legacy of the Bosnian genocide, and her experiences as a director. So welcome, Sabina. Thank you so much for joining us. We're very happy to have you here today. First off, could you please say a few words to introduce yourself to our listeners and to your work?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. This is such an honor. First, I just want to say this is my first time in Texas, and it's been quite an experience. I'm yet to be in a state that has so much sky, and I just keep staring at the sky and thinking, wow, this is so cinematic. So I've been, for the last 24 hours, going around Dallas and thinking, I can shoot a movie here. I just haven't figured out which one yet. So that's been a really wonderful welcome. I came to the United States as a refugee, like you mentioned, in the 90s. And it took me a second to get back into that subject matter because coming to this country was quite traumatic. The whole war and everything was quite traumatic. And I didn't really want to deal with it at first. And so coming back to these subjects now, kind of halfway through my career, has been an interesting and challenging experience.
It makes sense that you're only able to come to this topic belatedly. If you tried to do so earlier, you might not have been ready to deal with the reality of the trauma that you experienced. Although, correct me if I'm wrong. So I've already said, and of course we know this is why you're here today, that much of your work grapples with the Bosnian War and genocide and the legacy of these events in the present. So I wanted to know what motivated you to begin working on this topic and what perhaps are some of the difficulties involved in working on such a personally traumatic history.
Now, as we're talking, I'm like, well, no, it's not true, Sabina. I mean, your first film was about Bosnia. But I stumbled into that one. I didn't really think I was making a movie at first.
With Back to Bosnia?
With Back to Bosnia. So I was a theater director first. My undergrad was in theater directing. And so my family, we immigrated to Florida, settled in Florida as refugees. And I finished high school and college there. And I studied theater directing and then promptly moved to New York because I was like, you know, that's where everybody goes. And I'm a theater director and I have to go to New York. Fully expecting that New York was going to just be waiting for me to come, but New York couldn't care less. And and in sort of process of figuring out who I was and as an artist and not really dealing with my PTSD that I was suffering from, in the middle of all that, we got contacted by the Bosnian government to come and reclaim the property that we had to leave when we fled for our lives in the 90s. And I just thought I would go and record it, just kind of for fun, I don't know. And then as we started talking about it and I started talking to my parents about it, it became pretty clear that it was a bigger story than what I anticipated. And by the time that we finished recording and I came back with about 140 hours of footage and started working through it, I was like, oh, this is a film. And I started putting it together, but that process, because I really wasn't ready for it, it really was kind of triggering it triggered my trauma instead of healing it. Everybody always asks, like, wasn't it cathartic to make that movie? And I was like, no. I shut down even more after it. So in that way, yes, I made something about the subject matter very early in my career as my first film, but I wasn't really ready for that. And so I walked away from that subject matter and wrote and directed a whole bunch of short films that have nothing to do with that. And I really love horror, so there was a lot of horror movies and was still doing theater. And it wasn't really, I have to credit my master's program at USC. So I go to USC to get my master's in film. And at USC, they're very big proponents of telling your story that's uniquely your own, that nobody else is doing. And I don't know if there were other Bosnians before me in that program, but I was definitely the only one in my year. And so, of course, all my professors were pushing me to tell stories about my experience about Bosnia. And I didn't, what was interesting is revisiting that after I've gone through therapy and kind of healed myself of my trauma and figured out what was, because then I was coming back to it with a more objective eye as sort of, and this is how I approach it now, like, how do I tell these stories in a universal way that can be helpful to people as opposed to me healing my own trauma through the work that I'm creating? Because I don't need to heal. My trauma is its own beast that I'm handling and have handled outside of my work. And so then my work just becomes a way of connecting to other people who might be struggling across not just Bosnians, but different ethnicities and nationalities, and reaching out to them and saying, I understand what you're going through because I've been through it, and I'm going to tell it through this story that might entertain you, but then at the end of it, it might help you understand that you're not alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And that's such an amazing part of your work, is that, yes, it's universal, it's transnational, and might speak to all kinds of different experiences of trauma, whether they relate to war or not. But they are also so intimately bound with not only yourself, but also with what was happening in Bosnia at the time. It's good. Obviously, it's good to hear that now what you're doing right now and with variables, you had already dealt with your trauma in a way that felt productive to you. But I was really struck in Back to Bosnia with the moment at which you have this kind of confrontational conversation with this girl who's your age. You're both born in the same year, who's living in your apartment. I found it really upsetting to watch, but it definitely felt like that was really triggering for you. And I remember this one line that really stuck with me. You said something like, I was 14 when I left, and I felt like I suddenly became 40, because you're forced to confront these grim topics and these, you know, horrendous situations, and you're faced with losing your family at such a young age. It makes sense in that context that you needed more time to work on your PTSD.
Our parents felt they didn't have to really worry about us as much. Mm-hmm. And so since nobody was worrying about you, you had to take care of yourself. And I imagine that would be the same for kids who lose parents at that time. You know, I was fortunate that I didn't. Both of my parents survived the war. But they stopped taking care of me at 14. And I was no longer, they were still taking care of my brother, who's much younger than me. But everybody just stopped taking care of me. And so I had to start taking care of myself. And that's how you know, at 14, you become 40, because you have to grow up. You have to become an adult. You no longer feel like you can trust anyone in your life to help you. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a product of trauma that I carry into even to this day. It's very hard for me to believe that anyone in my life is actually going to help. And so when people do, especially when I don't ask for it and they just sort of out of the blue come, and in even a smaller way, like, come and get me at the airport, you know, I'm shocked. To me, that's like, whoa, what? I don't have to actually do it myself. And I feel like that's part of the trauma that haunts all of us. And I find that most of the Bosnians in my generation have overcompensated and become overachievers, and we're just all, you know, atop of our game because we kind of had to, not only for ourselves, but also for these parents that we felt we had to take care of in some way.
Mm, I can't imagine how difficult it must have been to try and assimilate within an entirely new alien society. You said yourself, you know, we were talking last night at dinner, you said, you know, most of you didn't speak the language. You were building up your own community and also dealing with this like monumental trauma that you shared.
Even though we grew up with American culture, it is such a different culture. And yet we look like Americans, you know, people kind of see us and are like, oh, you know. And so there wasn't as much, and there wasn't a Bosnian community here to begin with. Like, you know, there's other refugee communities are coming to America, and there is already an immigrant community from that country that has been here for 50 years or 10 years, whatever. But Bosnians, we didn't, you know, out of former Yugoslavia, the people who came to America were mostly Croatians and Serbs. And so they had booming communities, but we didn't. So for us, we were building a community at the same time as trying to survive the trauma that nobody was processing. Mm-hmm. Bosnians in general, and then the world, you know, overall, is like, they just covered it up. And like, yeah, there's this scab, but like underneath, it's rotting away. Like, you know, somebody put a Band-Aid on, you know, on and there's internal bleeding. And like, no one's addressing internal bleeding. They're like, oh, well, it's healed over. There's a scar, but, you know, but inside, they're rotting away and you're going to die, you know. And I just keep saying like, but what about this? But what about this? And they're like, can you, it's like, ouch, you're hurting me. Don't touch it. Just don't touch it. And I'm like, but why is it still hurting? Mm-hmm. Like, why are you not, you know, there's this book called The Untethered Soul that I read many years ago. And there's this image that the writer put in a book that like really stayed with me. And it was all about trauma, I guess, or traumatic events. And he said, you know, if you think about it, like when something bad happens to you that you label as bad, it could be, you know, you're ridiculed in school by your peers, or your mom yells at you, or your girlfriend, your boyfriend breaks your heart, like whatever it is, like something that triggers a negative emotion in you. What you end up doing is you create like some sort of a buffer against it, right? And so like next time that happens, you try, you know, not to engage in that sort of stuff. And so he put it as like, as if you have a thorn in your side, right? So like that comes in and it's a thorn. And so instead of pulling that thorn out and letting it heal, you cover it up with some sort of like a little thing. So he's like, so then by the time you come to a certain age, you're just covered in these things. And so no one can come and hug you. No one can come close to you. They can come about as this close, because otherwise they're going to push one of these things and trigger it. And then you end up being very isolated and alone because you're not letting anyone in, because, you know, you're afraid that they're going to touch this thorn that's been stuck there. And instead of, you know, just pulling it out. And I think about that a lot, you know, and I find that I, in my own personal way, and then in works that I make, I'm like, okay, here's a thorn. Like, let's pull it out and let's see what happens when we pull it out. And people just go like, no, like, it's going to hurt. I'm like, yeah, it's going to hurt temporarily.
Do you think that cinema played a role for you in regaining some of that lost time, or finding your identity as an immigrant who suffered all of these traumas in Bosnia?
I would say that in one way, I am incredibly, incredibly fortunate that I knew at the age of 8 that this is what I wanted to do. I made a big announcement to my family. I was going to be a film director. And they all laughed and they said, yeah, okay. You know, because none of them are professional artists. They're all just economists and doctors and lawyers and accountants.
But your dad, you said, was a cinephile.
Yes. I think I was 5 or 6 when I watched Scarface with my dad. There was definitely this, there was art. Arts was part of my family, but it was something that you are a patron of, or you did in your free time. But to do it as a career was just silly in everybody's mind. And so when I made that big announcement, everybody just said, okay, whatever. But my dad always, I mean, he said this to me once, and I think he's right. He said, you know, you'll succeed because you're too stubborn not to. Because for me, I am the type of person, if someone tells me you can't do it, I don't believe you can do it, I take it as a challenge and I want to prove everybody wrong. So the war happens. I'm 14. My parents find a way to get me out of the country in a nick of time. I was supposed to be taken to a camp if they didn't. And so they figure out a way to get me out of the country. And then I'm on my own for about 9-10 months before my mom comes out. And I don't see my dad for 3 more years after that. And in that time, as I'm trying to figure out what's going on, no one's explaining what's going on, I stumble across a theater company and they embrace me and make me one of their own. And I'm still stubbornly saying, I'm going to be a director. I'm going to be a director. And everybody then again is like, well, now you're a refugee. You're a war refugee. Like, drop that. Come up with something else. You know, I'm a straight A student. I'm a nerd by default. Now, when I reflect back, I think that's what saved me mentally and physically and emotionally, is just that throughout the entire upheaval of my life in those formative years, the one sort of North Star that I was holding on to was that I was going to be a film director. And that cinema in that way saved me, because I just, nothing else mattered. It didn't matter that I was without my parents. It didn't matter that we moved across the world and I left everyone behind. It didn't matter the trauma. It didn't matter all the struggle in America. What mattered is that I was doing it all in order to be a film director.
So in that way, perhaps cinema played some kind of therapeutic role in your journey.
Definitely. I would say definitely. And that is the power of art. And it's something that is misunderstood and underappreciated by the society that we live in.
You raise a really valuable point there, which is that your work isn't just, and of course it's culture and it's art, it also serves a distinctly pedagogical purpose, I think. And so perhaps this is a good time for me to scale things back and start talking about your 2019 film, Variables. The film begins with the following text, and I love this opening. Four ethnic groups, Serbs, Croats, Muslims and Jews have been living happily together for centuries, forging alliances and marriages across ethnic lines to the point where they all thought of themselves as simply Bosnians. And elsewhere in Back to Bosnia, for example, you talk about your neighbours, you say we were all the same. Can you give an overview of how and why inter-ethnic conflict in Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia came about in the 1990s, or at least to why this felt like an appropriate or a necessary opening for context for your audiences?
It was important for me to put that in that movie, and it's something that I keep repeating no matter where I go, is that when we came to America, the media here, the newspapers and TVs, what they were saying constantly is this 1,000-year hatred between these groups is finally culminated in this civil war. This was the rhetoric that we were bombarded with. And that was absolutely not true. And it is really upsetting to me that people still believe that, because that was just, it was easier, I think, because, you know, we're talking about some small country most Americans have never heard of. And it's much easier to understand to an average American, oh, there's these groups of people, they've all hated each other for centuries, and now they're finally culminating in this war. And it's much more complicated to understand the nuances that Bosnia actually represents. Perhaps there was some scholars and some people will tell you there is a centuries-long hatred between Serbs and Croats in those separate countries. But Bosnia is a very it's a very ethnically and religiously mixed country. It has always been that way. And, you know, even when the Ottoman Turks conquered us, it was the one place where the Sephardic Jews, when they were fleeing Spain, they could come and they were embraced by the community and just started living amongst us. They weren't segregated in a separate ghettos or anything like that. It was all about all these different ethnic and religious groups coexisting. And that is how I grew up. And in my family, people intermarried across all the different, and I never knew. It wasn't until the war started that I even knew that we fit in this one category called Muslim. And it wasn't, you know, on my dad's side of the family, people were religious, and, you know, I went to the mosque and I understood all that, and we celebrated, we call it Bayram, it's Eid, and, you know, Ramadan and all that stuff. But at the same time, my downstairs neighbor is a Catholic, and she asked my mom when I was born if she could be my godmother, and my mom said, yeah, sure, I mean, I don't know if that's what means something to you. And so she's my godmother, and we would go and celebrate Christmas with her and Easter, and you just had all these different, everybody celebrated everything. because it was just about being respectful and loving your neighbor, and neighbor and the connection of neighbors was what mattered. So it was us Bosnians versus anyone from the outside. And that's why when the war actually happened, it was as traumatic as it was for us, because it wasn't, sure, the outsiders came in, so the Serbs came in into the country, but then they started rallying up the Serbs that were living already in Bosnia for generations before and getting them to either look the other way or even join them in this. And so suddenly people who were your neighbors, who were your family members, who you've known for decades and sometimes in families for centuries, they were all intermarrying each other, turned on you. And that betrayal felt much more personal than if it was this idea that America was saying that, like, we all just hated one another, and then suddenly somebody that you hated forever came into your life and put a gun in your face, and you're like, yeah, okay, well, I expected them to do this because they hated us, quote unquote, you know? But when it comes from somebody that you didn't see coming at all, because you could never imagine it, because this person has been in your life since you were born, or since, you know, you married them. That's what made it much more difficult. And so the reason why it's important for me to talk about this is because of this misunderstanding from the American side, because then even when the Dayton Peace Accord was signed, that was something that was organized by the United States and stopped the war, and that was the good thing. But as part of it, they still stuck with this division. And our constitution is made in such a way that there's these three groups. There's Bosniaks, which is Bosnian Muslims, the word that they now use for it. There's Serbs and there's Croats. And that's how you, those are the three differentiations. And our government is now organized in that way. And there is a segregation in a country into these three, let's call them tribes, you know. And now, 30 years later, Bosnia is what America said we were when the war started. And that is really heartbreaking. And it is not how we were. It's not how Bosnia was for centuries before. And it is my hope that by repeating the story, it will come back to that, and that we will find a way to again coexist and live together, because that's what Bosnia really is.
I can imagine it being particularly painful, this idea of kind of neighborly violence, and I imagine that that's something to that contributes to this feeling of like mistrust that you mentioned, right? And it seems that this oversimplification and it's also, you know, coming from the UK, it's not just America, but the West more broadly, who adopts these kinds of reductionist narratives of ethnic hatreds. Of course, it serves to brush over the kind of nuances, but it also is self-serving in the sense that it means that they're not acknowledging their own role, not only in the way that Bosnia was ultimately divided in 1995 in December, but also the failure to intervene until it was too late by the UN. So in that way, it feels not just ignorant, but something maybe a little bit more insidious.
But I want to say that, you know, according to the historical books and facts that I've read, this was way before I was born, so I don't know if it's true. But basically everything that I read, Bosnians were called Bosnians by all the other previous, like Turks called us Bosnians when they were the conquerors. Before that, it was the Kingdom of Bosnia. We were a very powerful and strong medieval kingdom that managed to fight back Turks for many more decades than the rest of the surrounding regions. And it wasn't until the Austro-Hungarians came in, and we were under Austro-Hungaria for a brief period of time compared to the other conquerors. I feel like Bosnia has been conquered ever since we lost that kingdom in 1400s. We've basically been conquered throughout centuries, and that's part of our identity and part of our culture, is that our story and our history keeps being erased by all the conquerors that come, and the new generations aren't learning what our history was, and it's something that I'm deeply passionate about and trying to change. One of those things is that everyone called us Bosnians. We were Bosnians, and all the historical texts were Bosnians, not any other. And then you would have Bosnians off Roman Catholic religion, Bosnians off Muslim religion, Bosnians off Jewish religion. And it wasn't until the Austro-Hungarians came that in their books, and this is the beginning of 20th century, so early 1900s, that they're starting to differentiate us as, you know, Serbs, Croats, Bosnians, Jews. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who started dividing us like that. And up until that point, somebody who might have been born in Bosnia and they're the 10th generation, but they just happen to have come from Serbia at some point and still practice, you know, that Orthodox religion, they would have called themselves Bosnians. Mm-hmm. And that's how we called each other Bosnians during the Yugoslavia. We were the Bosnians, and then there was the Serbs were living in Serbia, Republic of Serbia, and the Croats were living in Republic of Croatia, and we were in Republic of Bosnia and Herzegovina. So we were the only differentiation we would say is like Bosnian versus Herzegovinian, and you know it just means if you're in Herzegovinian, you're from the south, you're from the southern part of the country, and so again, like it, you know, the Austro-Hungarians divided us up. And then we erased that and embraced being back to being Bosnians. And then now the West divided us up again for the last 30 years. And it is my hope that whenever, when things are said and done and whatever happens next, that we find our way back to that sort of unity of being just a Bosnian. Because right now, like if we just had elections in Bosnia as well. And when you register to vote, the three options that you have to register is Bosniak, Serb, or Croat. You cannot, there is no Bosnian as an option. So if I'm not one of those three, like what if I'm from a mixed marriage? Or what if I'm Jewish? Or what if I'm don't want to identify with religion?
So you're not even constitutionally recognized?
No, so we are other. So I click other, and most of my friends that I know click other. So somebody who was born in Bosnia, I'm an 8th generation Bosnian from my father's side, I am considered other. And that is absurd. And that's just because of this division from the West that was forced upon us. And I really hope that in the future political reform that hopefully happens without the war, in a very peaceful, diplomatic, democratic way, we find a way to embrace that label. Mm-hmm. Because I feel it's more true to who we really are.
It's sad to hear that this idea of a shared idea of Bosnianness is what connects you all, but that's precisely what's been exploited by various powers that have sought to separate you off, presumably for the purposes of subjugation, makes things easier, right?
Divide and conquer, right? Yeah. From the ancient Rome onwards.
And also to hear that shared Bosnianness makes up part of that identity of the country as one of survivors. Before I ask you this, can you just tell our listeners, give them a brief sense of the storyline of Variables before I ask you a question about it?
Sure. So Variables is a short film that is inspired by a true story that happened to a friend of mine. And it tells the story of a teenage math whiz who is in Bosnia, in Sarajevo specifically, during the war under siege. And his math club wins a national competition and gets invited to come to Canada to compete in the International Math Olympiad. And so he and his math club gets pulled out of Bosnia to go and compete in there. And then while he's in Canada, he's faced with a tough decision.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. And for all our listeners, you have to go and watch this film straight away. It's amazing, really impactful. So why did you choose to center this particular perspective, this perspective of a young teenage, high school age boy? Tell us that first.
Well, I first heard his story because I met this, you know, Radosh is a really good mutual friend. And so I met him through my friend Adnan, I would say, you know, 20 years ago now. And when he told me this, I just thought it was such an absurd concept that you have a bunch of kids in a war zone getting shot at by snipers, getting shelled, get no water, no food, no electricity, and you pull them out of that war zone not to save their life, but for them to go and compete in a math Olympics. Like, what? You know? And then you send them back, or you're supposed to send them back. Like, that, it seemed so, so bizarre. And so it stayed with me, of course, as a story. And I was doing theater that time, so it was just sort of, he told me the story, and I thought, wow, that's fascinating. And then here I am at USC, where they were pushing for us to tell stories of our own heritage and our own histories. And I remember that one, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I can turn that into a short film, because I needed something for my thesis. And then there's also Alfred P. Sloan Foundation offers grants for films about STEM subjects, and they offer a scholarship or a grant through USC. You can apply and win. And I thought, okay, that could be interesting. Like, I can turn this into my thesis and apply to hopefully get funding for it from Sloan, because thesis costs a lot of money. And so I did, and then I won, and I thought, oh, this is fantastic. Like, now I can, you know, make this with that money. And then when I started writing it and making it, it was interesting because, you know, I was a teenager at, he was the same age as me. And so, and my story was different than his, but in one sense, it was the same because we both end up in another country as kids, as teenagers, on our own without our family. And that part was something that I can latch onto and connect with. And so I'm not going to ruin the ending for people who haven't seen it yet, but I changed the ending to reflect more my story than his. In his case, it was a different ending because of that, because I wanted to have my own sort of an in into it. And going back to what we're just talking about, this interconnectedness of cultures and religions and ethnicities in Bosnia, I also wanted to address that, because to me, those kids that come from mixed, we call them mixed marriages. It's kind of absurd for Americans because, like, it's not two races, right? So, but in Bosnia, it's the same as being a biracial kid. It's, you're treated the same way nowadays, especially in this very segregated country. And I find that I struggle with my own identity. I can't even imagine how it is for somebody who has to split between two different groups. And so I decided to, even though Radosh isn't, I decided to make the protagonist somebody who has a Serb dad and a Muslim mom, to address that and to see that neither side knows what to do with him. And he's an enemy for both, and especially as a young boy, because as a boy, you're called into the arms and you're supposed to fight. And so which side do you fight on? And I wanted to use that and him as a person to represent Bosnia, because to me, that is much more Bosnian than somebody who comes just from one side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and in that way, the film really shows the kind of indiscriminate nature, not only of war and conflict, right, and that it spares no one, doesn't spare children, but also of these kinds of neighborly, inter-ethnic, neighborly tensions, right? So he's obviously a schoolboy, but he almost doesn't make it to the Olympiad precisely because of these tensions and precisely because of who his father was. And what is really interesting about the short for me is that you feel like you're spending way more time with the protagonist than, you know, you actually have. You learn a lot from him and what's important to him and his personality. And why did you choose to make this movie a short?
I chose to make it a short because it was my thesis, and the amount of money that I had could only make a short. But I initially, when I was first thinking about a story, I thought it would be a feature. And there was a part of me that feels like it could still be turned into a feature if I got the funding to do it. Because I think there is much more of the story and sort of these themes that we keep coming back to. Because to me, the children in war zones and what happens to them is not as explored as all the other subjects. And it was interesting because I just spent 4 months in Bosnia just this spring, summer, and it was the longest I've been to Bosnia since I fled during the war. And it was interesting spending time with people there now who are in their late 30s, who were kids, you know, and especially people in Sarajevo who were in basements and spend their basically their childhood, 4 years of their childhood in basements. It was really fascinating talking to them, because across the board, they all say there's nothing, they have no trauma, they have nothing, you know, they just erased it, it's all fine. But then at the same time, everybody is smoking a lot, drinking a lot, you know, smoking weed a lot, like whatever is the substance to sort of cover up whatever is this trauma that they claim they don't have. And I find that it's because, again, this idea that because you don't show it on the outside, there's nothing wrong with you inside, and pressure to just move on and be a survivor and not address the underlying problems, that to me is something that I feel like, as someone who has experienced that and lived through it, I want to find a way to show it in the art that I make.
Yeah, for sure. And that takes us quite nicely into another question I had, which broadly I've couched this question in the context of Back to Bosnia, but it relates to all of your work, really. So Back to Bosnia deals, we've already spoken about this a little bit, among other things, with the aftermath of war and genocide and the difficulties faced by refugees like your own family with returning home. Can you provide some insight into the legacy of how this conflict is remembered or forgotten today in Bosnia?
It was very interesting because I feel like in Bosnia, people are tired, as they say, of talking about it. But I think it's because no one's really talking about it. They're tired of the story, of the same story of actual war. But people aren't really talking about the trauma of it. And because it isn't part, it's really, even in 2022, people in Bosnia still consider therapy to be something that only the crazy people do. And when you say that you go to a therapist, it's like something you're shamed of, and you say it like quietly to your friends. To me, living in America and somebody who benefited a great deal from therapy, I don't understand. Like, well, you know, the entire country has to go. and I think because of that, the same way that if you have suffered some sort of traumatic event and then haven't gone to therapy and moved on, you don't want to talk about it because it's triggering for you to talk about it because you haven't addressed the underlying pain that it caused you and the trouble that it then you are haunted by and you can't sleep for days to come. So nobody wants to talk about it because it's triggering. And especially in terms of film, there's a lot of criticism that a lot of films are about war. It's still about the war. And I was even asked in one of the interviews when I was there, I was like, why do you keep talking about war? Like, why is it? And I say it's because we aren't talking about it at home. Like, nobody, you know, there's kids growing up not knowing what happened, you know? And because of this political correctness, there, because nobody wants to make anybody upset and all the politicians are fighting and all this stuff. In a textbook, a person told me this, his son is in sixth grade, and in his history textbook, the war in Bosnia, in which 200,000 people died and 2 million people were misplaced, it's called an unfortunate accident. Wow. And it's just one line of text, and then they move on to other matter. Like, it's not even discussed. They don't even have a class in which they talk about it, not one session. And that, to me, is crazy. It's the two, three new generations that have been born since the war that the parents aren't talking about at home. They're not learning about it at school, or what they're learning is not thorough. And so what's going to happen next? I mean, there's this phrase in Bosnia that every 50 years there's another war, and we are 30 years in. So what, in 20 years we're going to have another war in order to fix what we didn't, because nobody's talking about it. And I think that's problematic. I think that it is on us who survived and who found a way to express what we went through, to teach the next generations, to teach the ones coming up. And ultimately what we need to teach them is the humanity in us all, and that war is bad and people are good and bad, and that's it. That's the only division that you have. And that war brings out the worst in people. So whatever you can, you have to figure out how not to get into that, because no one wins in war other than war profiteers.
I feel like this kind of reluctance to talk plays into the hands also of, unfortunately, increased like ethno-national discourse there and elsewhere in Europe, and also of historical revisionism, which is perhaps what is reflected in a textbook that you described. I don't know who's responsible for the textbook, but given the context that you've just provided for dealing with these events in Bosnia right now, what has the reception of your works been in Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia, other former Yugoslav states?
I find that people who respond the most to my work are actually not in that region. Mm-hmm. I find that my work has been the most appreciated outside, like in the United States and then in other countries that I've been to. I think precisely because of that sort of desire not to talk about it. And so they see my work, they're like, oh, come on, you know, again. And there's always going to be some sort of criticism about what I'm doing. And it's like, it wasn't like that. And I feel like I'm constantly under attack from the people in a region. Like, I have a lot of fans and a lot of supporters. I also have a lot of critics, a lot of haters, much more there than anywhere else. So I guess the succinct answer to what you're asking is complicated.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. And again, just quickly, can you share some of your experiences of what it's been like to navigate the film world as not only a young director, but as somebody carrying this trauma?
Hollywood is notorious for being all the wrong isms, right? And there's been a lot of push to change that in the last handful of years. And I think it's really great for the new generations coming up. I hope they're not going to have as much trouble. But it has definitely been a difficult journey for me as a woman, as a refugee, as somebody who wants to tell stories that don't necessarily have happy endings, that are asking you to dig into your own darkness and confront your own demons. And that to me is interesting because I find that we're so programmed not to do that, that media is entertainment, it's escapism. And I feel like that us as media makers have an enormous responsibility because we as human beings are going around the world believing the stories in our heads. And us media makers are the ones who put those stories into people's heads. And so if the only thing that we're putting into people's heads is happy-go-lucky and everything's going to work out, and, you know, then I find that a lot of people walk around going, well, what's wrong with me? When everybody else, you know, all the stories that I read and watch, and everyone has it worked out in the end. They get the guy, they get the girl, they get the job, they live happily ever after, and I'm not. So what is wrong with me? And I think that's could be quite triggering for any sort of mental health issues, that which could be as simple as anxiety. And I feel like I really want to tell my stories to help people struggling with those questions and show them that, again, that they're not alone. But I find that my industry, the film industry, is still having a really hard time accepting that as another way of entertaining, let's call it that. So I struggle trying to tell my stories, but I tell them anyway, because as my dad said, I'm too stubborn not to.
And we're so happy you're so stubborn, and we're thankful that we have you to infiltrate Hollywood. Yes.
I will do my best. I will do my best.
No, but really, like, you're doing people a service, but also your works are so sensitive. And because our you know, this is the Ackerman Center podcast, of course we're concerned more broadly with human rights and other genocides, but we are first and foremost Holocaust Center. And your new film Sevat Mitzvah deals with this history. I know you can't say too much right now, but could you talk a little bit about your upcoming film Sevat Mitzvah and its entanglement of Jewish with Muslim heritage?
Absolutely. It wasn't intentional, but it seems like my movies are all about true stories these days. But it's based on a true story. It's inspired by a true story of these two families. And I focus on the two wives, two women in those families, a Muslim and a Jewish family, neighbors in Bosnia. And in 1941, the Jewish family, of course, is being rounded up, or the Jews are being rounded up by the Nazis. And the Muslim woman decides to risk everything to save her Jewish friends. And they help get them out of the country, and the Jewish family ends up in Israel. And then 50 years later, during the Bosnian War, when the Muslims are the ones being hunted down, the Jewish family finds a way to get them out of the country in turn. And to me, that sort of reciprocity of goodness begetting goodness is a message that I wholeheartedly believe in, and also the message of when the war comes knocking on your door, the label that somebody might have means nothing when you're faced with a child with humanity. Are you going to save humanity, or are you going to worry if that humanity is wearing the right clothes and has the right label? Mm-hmm. And that's what I really want that film to remind us, especially in these very divisive times that we live in. And I really hope that that's the message that everybody gets from it.
Well, I've only seen the trailer, but it looked really powerful, and I can't wait. When is it going to come out?
We are finishing it up now and aiming for early 2023. Premiere, so be on a lookout.
Yes, keep your eyes peeled, and we'll provide links to both films in our description. Thank you so much, Sabina, for your time. You're a brilliant speaker. We wish we could spend more time with you, and thank you to our listeners also.
Thank you for inviting me, and I also want to thank your listeners. I hope that they got something out of this that is enlightening in some small way.
This podcast is hosted by a team of dedicated faculty and research assistants at the Ackerman Center for Holocaust Studies.
You can learn more about our work and find upcoming events at our website, www.ackerman.utdallas.edu.